and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I am your host, Rebecca Christie. We are going to talk today about the economics of defense on both sides of the Atlantic. My guests today are Guntram Wolf, Bruegel's former director and now an economist working on defense policy, among other things, here at Bruegel as a fellow, and then Sharon Weinberger, who is one of my personal heroes, who has written two books about defense contracting specifically and DARPA and all of the weird things the U.S. military has done. One of them is called The Imagineers of War, and the other one is called Imaginary Weapons. She's written another book about U.S. nuclear sites, and she has a new book coming out about the military and the Silicon Valley defense industry. We are going to talk about how things are looking, how we can think about defense spending and defense buying and defense making of things, and what it means in this very uncertain and somewhat war-torn geopolitical environment. So hang on to your seats. Here we go. Sharon, what's going on right now? Where is defense procurement, particularly given that there's a war? It seemed like for such a long time, the focus was on super high tech, and now suddenly we were talking about like bullets and basic things, and now we're talking about drones. Like, what even is happening?
Well, there's a lot of different trends that are going on at the same time and converging in part as a result of the Iran operations against Iran. We're expending munitions, we're expending missiles. So the biggest shift that you're seeing from the industry side, from a sort of a funding into defense perspective, is the massive influx of venture capital into defense industry. I think PitchBook, which does some of the most reliable numbers, estimated that it was $50 billion going into startups last year from venture money. On the flip side of that, you have the Pentagon, which is dealing with two things: acquisition programs that are overcost, way behind schedule, legacy programs, and then the, as I just mentioned, you know, the dearth of munitions that we have in things that we need and are using on an everyday basis, and then wanting to take advantage of and push to buy things from some of these new defense startups, but in some cases lacking whether it's the funding or mechanisms to do that. And all of that is sort of coming to a head in the current administration.
Guntram, you've done a lot of work on the shortfalls in Europe right now. What do we need and what are we trying to get?
Well, I would say in Europe, the situation is a bit different. We have two sort of intertwined debates. One is about sort of the catching up of military equipment purchases that have been really low for 25 years during the so-called peace dividend. And since 2022, when the last people finally realized that this illusion of the end of history is actually an illusion, They started to sort of increase defense spending very substantially on equipment, just to give that number, from 0.3% of GDP, NATO Europe defense equipment spending, to now something like 0.7% and increasing further. So this is a massive shift. And it meets a very, very limited defense industrial base that is fragmented, that is small, and that finds it difficult to scale, and sometimes doesn't have the right incentives to scale up front. And we can discuss those incentives in more detail later. So I think that's sort of one big debate. The other big debate is about sort of what kind of technologies do we need and where do we buy them from, right? And so I think the Iran war has served as yet another confirmation that technology is moving very fast and is changing rapidly, and that basically a lot of the stuff that we've been buying is nice, but basically way too expensive to deal with the kind of threats that are coming at us. So shooting down Shahed drones that cost $20,000 with two Patriot missiles, each worth several million, is not a particularly good idea. The other technology dimension is, I would say, on the European side, very much a question now of what kind of U.S. technology do we buy, and with that technology, what kind of strategic dependence do you buy? And that's a political question at some level, because obviously if you have a well-functioning system based on a US software and the US government decides to use that leverage and not update that software, that's a direct vulnerability. But it's also really an industrial dimension, because we know that all the Patriot missiles or the HIMARS and so on will be used elsewhere. And we've just seen, I think, Rebecca, we discussed that. For example, Estonia was told by Pete Hegseth that they wouldn't get their HIMARS missiles for some time because they need them elsewhere. And, you know, that's a big blow for a small country like Estonia that was really hoping to finally get these HIMARS.
Sharon, what's your sense of how the U.S. is using its military supply situation? You know, we've got three carriers going to the Strait of Hormuz. Last time I checked in, there is this situation with these very expensive weapon systems being used up, some people might say. What's your sense? Like, how is the U.S. managing? Are they using their stuff wisely? Are they using it unwisely? Are they even talking about it? Or are they just...
I mean, that's the strategic question. I mean, there's two parts to that. I mean, don't forget, up until, you know, a year ago. So there's a big confusion inside what, not just the Pentagon, but sort of might call the national security community in Washington, which is, for the past number of years, I mean, going back now almost 10 years, we have been forever pivoting to Asia. Or if we want to go back even further to that, you know, we were pivoting to Asia until September 11th, 2001, when they had to suddenly rewrite the Quadrennial Defense Review very, very quickly because, oh, it turns out terrorism is important. So, you know, as long as I've been in this business, which is now over 25 years, we've been always pivoting to Asia and then something else comes up. So on one hand, it's sort of shocking that you might say that the Trump administration was pivoting to China and then suddenly we're in Iran and we're, you know, blowing up suspected drug boats in the Caribbean. But on the other hand, in sort of the bigger trend of the United States, it's not surprising because we have never successfully pivoted to Asia. So there's the strategic, I don't know what to call it. I think people use strategic ambiguity in a different sense. I'm going to use strategic ambiguity because who knows what is going on in that. It is very clear, and I think there's a lot of coverage of the fact that we're both, you know, taking carriers, we're concentrating in a region that we weren't supposed to be pivoting towards, and we are very quickly spending down the munitions that were specifically built up for a potential war in the Indo-Pacific. So that's on the strategic side, just pure, utter confusion. On the procurement side, it is brought to sort of this, you know, a high point, this tension of that's been known for a long time, which is the industrial base. And that is what Ukraine showed as well, that the biggest military arsenal in the world and the biggest defense industrial base could not produce enough munitions to supply Ukraine like we needed. Well, that war is still going on. And now we have spent down our munitions even more. So there is this big push for procurement. And there's a lot of pronouncements on the Pentagon side. And they're using creatively a lot of the authorities that have been developed over the number of years. And so I see statements about, you know, legacy contractors are going to, you know, they're going to expand their factories, they're going to increase munitions, but we actually haven't seen the results of that yet. So I don't want to say like those efforts are going to come to nothing, but I'm a, you know, slightly suspect. Some of the problems that still exist is, you know, they don't have multi-year authorities to give contracts from Congress. All like, I don't see fixed all of the things that have prevented a surge in production. On the flip side, what they're also doing is making big efforts to work with a lot of these defense startups, some of which are making bold claims about being able to produce faster, better, cheaper. Again, that may be true, but it's too early to judge whether that's going to happen.
The U.S. for such a long time seemed to be in this cycle of contracts where there were fewer and fewer widgets being made for higher and higher prices, at longer and longer delays because of all the appeals processes in deciding who is going to get to make the few widgets that would be built. Is that cycle still ongoing?
I mean, people are still appealing contracts, yes. Is that the bottleneck right now? I don't think that's the bottleneck. I think the bottleneck, like, so, solid rocket motors, there were only two suppliers. Now you have more startups in that area. I do think like good things is going to come out of that. Like two was way too few. Having more involved, whether they're successful or not, like, I think they might be successful, but competition is going to increase output. Like that's a good thing. I think expanding the industrial base is an inherent good. But, it's kind of where does the rubber meet the road? Because right now, it's too early to say that this is working. I mean, you can tell that we have not increased production for some of our key munitions. And I'm a little, we've been talking about this for a few years right now. So I think we'll see effects, but I don't know that we're going to see effects in time for current operations in Iran. You see a lot of rhetoric like drone dominance. We're going to buy hundreds of thousands of drones. And that's great, I guess, but that doesn't. Just saying it doesn't solve the supply chain issues. It doesn't solve the fact that the reason we can't produce small, cheap drones in the United States is because we don't own all of the supply that goes into it the way China does, the gimbals, the sensors, all the things it takes to produce relatively cheap small drones. So none of those problems are solved yet. I don't mean to be a pessimist. Like they may get better. They probably will, but not right now.
And Guntram, you mentioned Ukraine sort of being a game changer here. It seems like the military support between the EU and Ukraine has not gone always in the way people expected, right? Because the EU has been giving Ukraine lots of money and lots of support, but also Ukraine's ability to manufacture stuff has in some ways been stronger than what other parts of the continent have done.
I think the Ukraine issue is very particular in the sense that the country is, of course, in a hot war for many years now. It has prepared. It has, by the way, a long history in technology, defense technology. Some of the upper-end military procurement, military products that the Soviet Union used were already produced in Ukraine. And so they could draw on a significant defense industrial base. But I think the key for Ukraine's success in military production has really been a very substantial reform of the procurement system, which decentralized procurement in a massive way, made it much more performance-driven, much more agile, much more digital, much more immediate compared to long procurement processes that we have elsewhere. And combine that with very substantial external funding and external provisioning of also supplies that are needed, plus cooperation with companies across the continent. So I think here the procurement agility is key. And I would say with the procurement agility, the competition that it introduces into the system among the suppliers. And that's really, if you allow me that excursion, that is really the fundamental issue when it comes to the lack of investment in capacity, production capacity across the continent. I mean, we see that for products for which there is a standardization, for which there is a joint market, take the old-fashioned 155 millimeter artillery shells. For these products, we've seen a massive expansion of production capacity and actually a huge decline in the costs. I mean, the price of a 155 artillery shell has fallen by more than 50% over the last two or 3 years in Europe. So this is massive. And it is a result of the competition of having one standard and several producers across several countries, several buyers across several countries. So it looks like a real marketplace, right? Now, when it comes to your typical national champion that supplies you with everything from, I don't know, the underwear to your tank, I mean, then it's a different matter. And basically that national champion will always know that it's in a bilateral monopoly with its government and can just basically charge whatever and is not investing sufficiently. And the result is, frankly speaking, massive overpayments, absurdly high prices for some of the products that some of our key military procurement offices are procuring. And so I think really there, the structural debate we need to have is all about how do you open up the markets? How do you make sure that there is competition? How do you make sure that procurement offices don't just go to their national champions, but go beyond? How do you integrate the Ukraine defense industrial base into the European procurement stack?
Thanks for that. In the next part of our podcast, I want to talk more about innovation and the military-industrial complex. We in Europe hear so much about the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency out of the Pentagon and how this has brought this amazing supported ecosystem of fabulous innovations into this space. The reality of DARPA is maybe a little smaller and a little different than people might have in mind. Sharon, you're the expert. Tell us all about it. What do we need to know?
I mean, to go back to the beginning, for those who don't follow it, DARPA was formed in 1958 as a result of a larger reshuffling of the national security community in the wake of the launch of Sputnik, the first artificial satellite that the Soviet Union launched. So before the creation of NASA, there was DARPA, or it was actually called ARPA at the time, the Advanced Research Projects Agency, which took all of the satellite programs, all of the different rocket programs that were intended to get us into space. There were duplicative competitive efforts and put them under one agency that was going to get us into space. It did that. And then, you know, in about a year, it lost the space mission once NASA was created, at least for civilian space. But it was given this larger remit, DARPA meaning, to look ahead at technologies, or what became known as technological surprise, to come up with weapon systems technologies, things that had not been thought of, sort of long-term efforts not tied to the military services. And it has produced, as a result of that, a lot of the military technologies and civilian ones that we, you know, are now very familiar with. Drones came out of the early work of DARPA, particularly during the Vietnam War. We have stealth aircraft on the civilian, well, and also military side. We have ARPANET, which became the modern internet. So, you know, even arguably, not even arguably, quite certainly, the current AI, LLMs, trace their lineage directly to DARPA's work in computer science over the decades. So then the question that I think some might disagree with me on is, what does DARPA do now? My argument that I think some would take issue with, but I think is grounded in a lot of research on the issue, DARPA today is a very good agency that still does very good work for the Department of Defense. It does good, important innovations, but it no longer serves the function it once did, which was to serve both the president and or the Secretary of Defense on the biggest national security problem. Like, you know, if the biggest problem is terrorism, or if it is China, that DARPA was once the lead agencies on these national security issues. Now it's more, you know, it's an innovative funding agency. It's part of what you might call the defense research ecosystem, better than most, if not all, of those agencies. I don't know that it is the critical node today for national security. I'm sure people at DARPA would take issue with that, but I think, you know, that's grounded in reality.
And they may have invented the internet back in the day, but they also did weird things, right? Like study ESP and whether they could talk to animals. Like, what about that side of it?
Yeah, I mean, it did a lot of bizarre stuff. So yeah, I actually defended on the ESP parapsychology work, because in that case, it was that the CIA was funding it. There was enthusiasm from Congress. And so the CIA was pushing DARPA because, you know, DARPA had deep pockets. So it kind of wanted DARPA to pitch in. And they did the right thing in that case. There are times when they've done the wrong thing. They did the right thing that they put a program manager, a DARPA employee on it, who was kind of known for being into the counterculture. And like, we got our counterculture guy. You know, he hangs out with those people. And they put him on it to evaluate the CIA work. So he marches out or flies out to the Stanford Research Institute, where a lot of the CIA-funded work was going on. And he came back and just said, like, look, this is all BS. It's just stupid. Like, I had a lot of fun. I hung out with witches and parapsychologists, but this is dumb and we should not fund it. And DARPA never did fund it, very much to its credit. Now, what DARPA doesn't like to talk about it today is that it has funded a lot of dumb stuff. And they'll sometimes defend it, saying, well, you know, you can't have, you know, successes come from high risk projects. And that's true. But you need to know what is high risk, high payoff, and high risk, and like just foolish. And sometimes they've done that, like with ESP, where they did not fund it. And sometimes they got involved into, you know, pretty stupid stuff. I mean, the subject of my first book, which was more sort of an example of bad science in the Pentagon, was they got enthralled with this physicist in Texas who claimed to have the ability to build sort of a fourth generation nuclear weapon based on an isomer called hafnium. Okay, that was dumb, and they were coming up with plans to build hafnium plants. that was sort of high risk foolish. I think overall, DARPA's approach has been a sensible one. Some of their bigger failures came out of the Vietnam War. Like, they always like to talk about their successes. The failures, I would say, like, they were the responsible, solely responsible for the introduction of Agent Orange into Vietnam as part of their counterinsurgency work. So, like all places, there's a mix of both.
Gunsham, how would that work in Europe? Do we have the failure tolerance over here to come up with something with so many misses as well as hits?
I think the first point I want to make is that we don't really have a very good comprehensive strategy for research innovation in the defense sector. And I think the first point here to make is we spend much less on defense R&D than the US. The order of magnitude is literally like 10-15% of what the US spends. So this is already a huge difference. And if we do, I don't think we do that really at a European level at a significant scale. So what we do is most of that research spending is probably at the national level. It's fragmented. It's sort of pet projects of individual countries. It is in some cases where we talk about sort of joint ventures or wider European companies working quite well, right? I mean, so think about the missile programs, MBDA. I mean, there are some successful companies where you can really see that it works. But sort of to think that this is a comprehensive strategy, continent-wide strategy, I think would be a stretch. That's the first point. The second point is, yeah, do we have the risk tolerance? Well, I mean, I think governments in general don't really have that kind of risk tolerance. They will always think of this in terms of, oh my God, if something goes wrong, I have to go to the parliament and basically explain why it has gone wrong. While I think the right answer in principle, that's the economist speaking, is, well, it should go wrong from time to time. That's a sign that, we go for the high-risk stuff. Now, I like your differentiation, high-risk dumb and high-risk smart. So that's a great way of distinguishing it. And of course, you have to be sure what is the smart bit and what is the dumb bit, ex ante, and you need good people for that and so on. And so I think these kind of things are being debated here. But I would probably assume that policymakers on this side of the Atlantic are probably more risk adverse.
How does that play into the current push in Europe to develop some sort of joint procurement? Do we have different risk tolerances in play, or is it purely a money issue?
I think in part it's an issue about sort of national preference. You really want to sort of beef up your local industrial base because there's jobs associated with it and so on and so forth. So collaboration is difficult. Even in a federal state, it's of course not easy, but in a group of states, it's even more difficult. So that's part of it. I would say the risk tolerance is probably not the main hurdle between different countries collaborating. I think it's more questions of ownership control of the companies and the assets that result from it. And so there, I mean, let me advertise sort of a new research that is coming out soon at Bruegel, where we do look explicitly at the control of defense companies across the world, actually, and the role of the government in these defense companies. And what you can see is that in the European Union, there's lots of mixed models, quite a bit of market ownership, very little government involvement. But in some countries, there's much stronger government involvement into the governance, into the boards of these defense companies. The problem then becomes, well, if you are France and you have your national champion, and the government has a strong control of that national champion, that's great. But unfortunately, you're too small to really get the scale that you need to stay competitive in a sort of in the wider race on very expensive equipment. So you have to sort of form consortia with other countries. How do you organize them? What kind of governance models can you create? I think MBDA and Airbus are examples where the governance model works. But even those still sort of have key assets being segmented across national lines. So countries really insisting on the physical presence of some of the key production assets. And so a vision where this could go would be, if there's more convergence on the security side, is to to really sort of stop with the segmentation of assets and really come to unified companies that have a unified CEO, an ownership structure where all governments are somehow involved, but none can hold up the other and the company as a whole.
How does that compare to the US experience, where we saw this huge wave of consolidation and then maybe got a sense that that had been too much?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the conversation that's going on here. So you have sort of the 800-pound gorilla in the room for defense industry right now is Palantir, which is one of what are often called the neo-prime. So you have the big five defense contractors, Northrop, Boeing, Lockheed, General Dynamics, RTX, and then you have the rise of, you know, start. I mean, Palantir at this point is no longer a startup. It's been around since about 2003, but it is, you know, often called a neo-prime. You have Anduril, another one of these new defense companies, you know, a potential neo-prime, and others as well. So Palantir in particular has pushed this narrative that the consolidation of the defense industry, often traced back to the Last Supper in the 1990s, when the head of the Pentagon basically told the defense companies, like, our budgets are going down, there's the peace dividend, you know, consolidate or die, and they did. Now, the truth is, so the narrative out of that that's now being pushed is the Last Supper was a disaster, we had this consolidation, prices went up, you know, everything was behind schedule. You know, the truth was that the consolidation traces much further back to financial engineering of the 1980s and the weakness of the defense industry. But putting that aside, the basic narrative is that I think is okay in some senses, is that having, you know, five big primes is not good for competitions. It did drive up prices. So to reverse it, you know, the argument is, you know, you have these new neo-primes, you have dozens and dozens of startups, and they will help us increase production and bring prices down. I think undoubtedly, you know, some of that will happen, you know, how much it will happen, and more importantly, how should the Pentagon respond? Because none of this works unless the Pentagon is willing to buy from these new companies. But then you get into all these complex questions is, well, does just adding a few neo primes to supplant the current primes, is that going to be better? Or are you just recreating the system? Those are the very difficult questions that I think the Pentagon is grappling with. Like, how do you buy from these new companies? What is the best way to do it? How do you support them? Because they're, you know, a lot of them are going to die. You know, this, you know, billions and billions of dollars that has gone into defense startups, like, there's no way they can all survive. Like, even venture capital doesn't think they're, you know, the whole thing of venture capital is you make bets, a few will go big and many will die. So how this all shakes out is very much to be seen. I guess what I'm curious about is, I know that there are European defense startups, some of them funded even by, you know, Peter Thiel, who has been behind Palantir, Anduril, like, I am really curious to know what are the prospects for the European defense startups and how they're being regarded by the governments there and what their route is into these budgets, which is a very different, you know, it's a different political and economic atmosphere.
Right. Just a few remarks on this. I think the first is that in Europe, we see quite a few of defense startups emerging around Munich, around Paris, in all kinds, in the Baltics, in many places, there's these kind of companies emerging. Some of them look very interesting with, you know, interesting products, drone technology, hypersonic missiles, land-based robotics. I mean, really interesting companies. Now, the issue that these companies are facing is certainly, the biggest issue is certainly how to get access to procurement, how to get access to the big pockets of the big countries' defense ministries. Because for them, the issue of fundraising in the capital markets is not the key obstacle. I talked with one of a CEO of one of those startups, and he tells me basically, okay, if I get a 10 million contract with my government, you know, I can raise easily 100 million in the capital markets. I mean, so this is really not the key constraint. The key constraint is, do you get access to an actual order, an actual procurement? And there, indeed, the question of ownership is becoming a very politicized and political issue. We have had the recent example of Stark, a drone manufacturer around Munich, which was scheduled to get a pretty big order by the German government, And because of political pressure due to Peter Thiel's ownership in part ownership in this company, which probably was less than any veto ownership. I mean, we don't know these numbers for sure, but back of the envelope calculations suggest that it's probably below the 20, if not even below the 10% threshold. So no blockage possible by Peter Thiel on this company. But, of course, he's involved. And he's not, as you can imagine, not a very popular figure on this side of the Atlantic. I guess in some places in the US, it's also still not a popular figure when he talks about the Antichrist in Rome and elsewhere. But anyway, I mean, putting that aside, he is certainly a controversial figure on this side of the Atlantic. And correspondingly, there was a big pushback against that company by major MPs in the German parliament, which I think led to a smaller order going to that company.
I really have been wondering about the optics of this industry more than ever. We see with Palantir, they're in the news for things like providing the artificial intelligence that the immigration raids in the US have been using, perhaps extra legally. And also they're in the New York Times for selling a $239 French chore coat for people who want a little Palantir design. Sharon, is this just all one big PR exercise? Like, what on earth?
I mean, to be honest, this is a lot of what my upcoming book, Valley of Death, covers. Like, what is behind this and what does it mean? So let's break this into two parts. I was sort of aware of the Stark Defense issue, but that was fascinating what you said about it. Because in the United States, like, you know, Peter Thiel's, you know, sort of controversial reputation has not been a hindrance to sales. And if anything, something that he backs is now a brand name. So let's take the two parts of Palantir that have been brought up in this conversation. The political element, where you both have Peter Thiel's role, but and then more importantly, Alex Karp, the CEO of Palantir, the head of Palantir, who, you know, TV after TV appearance, you know, he's talking, we're part of the kill chain. Sometimes we kill people. We kill, like, sort of embracing what some might consider controversial, but they're making their mantra, like the idea of their company. So there's two parts to that. I mean, Alex Karp has, and Peter Thiel to a certain extent too, have always sort of leaned into this narrative that the company has of defending the West, standing with Israel. That has been sort of part of the company's ethos going back to its beginning, but it's, in some ways it's become much more vocal now. So I think part of that is, I mean, undoubtedly it is marketing. It is very hard. You know, Palantir can talk about its targeting software. That's one part of what it does. It is essentially, you know, it's an enterprise software system. The other companies do this. But in some ways, the way they're differentiating themselves from other companies is with this sort of very, you know, whether you call it patriotic, nationalistic rhetoric, that is becoming their brand. That is becoming the way they differentiate themselves. And it's working. It's working particularly under the second Trump administration. The question you have to ask yourself is what happens in the next administration? But we can talk about that. The second part, the branded merchandise. So right now, Palantir is the most, on the stock market, is the most valuable defense company in the world. It has reached value, you know, market caps up to, you know, I think $485 billion. It's less now. It's come down about 25%. It is still the most valuable defense company in the world, more valuable on the stock market than Lockheed Martin. But here's the thing. Palantir has a fraction of the revenues of Lockheed. It's sort of like the upside down of our entire stock market now, but that's just amazing. The most valuable defense company in the world has a fraction of the revenue of the big five. Okay, so what is propping that up? And I will get to the Couture clothing. So a lot of that, which has been written about by Wall Street Journal and others, is it has avid fans, retail investors. Like Tesla, it has a very, very high percentage of retail investors. And they're in the Reddit chats, they're on social media, and they are devoted fans. They buy this clothing. They buy, and this is where it gets back to the narrative. They love the Alex Karp TV appearances where, you know, he, you know, will talk about we kill American enemies and we kill their families and we kill their mistresses. And so it's a melding of the narrative of the company with this very avid fan base. I think it's been called a meme, it is a meme stock in many senses, but it's a meme stock, which for Palantir, it's working. Will it work? That works until it doesn't. That's the fascinating question. I am not a good prognosticator. At some point when that stock comes back to earth, like what happens with all this? What happens when that narrative doesn't mesh with a new administration? Those are all fascinating questions for the future that I don't yet have answers to.
This is so fascinating in a European context on so many levels, but particularly because we don't have that culture of retail stock investing. We don't have a culture of retail capital market investing in general. And going from the current state of savings accounts and insurance products and these like very, very overthought and very careful pension products to a situation where you have this global behemoth that can sell t-shirts to its retail investors as another way of interacting with them is really foreign to where we are over here. Guntram, what do you make of it?
I look at this more through the lens of a typical economist that would say, okay, what does the stock market price reflect? It reflects the expectations of all future revenues, right? And so to the extent that you think that AI and data-driven defense is the future, I mean, you bet on a company that is specialized on that, right? And yes, there is a political dimension to it. And, when you were saying the next administration, I was almost hearing myself say, you mean the next Trump administration, but hopefully not. I mean, so hopefully there will be not a third term of the sitting U.S. president. But, perhaps that's being priced partly, right? I mean, perhaps there is sort of the sense that there is a change here and politics will permanently have shifted toward a new kind of rhetoric where killing becomes fashionable, where the use of Palantir products in ICE raids is sort of the new normal. And, that's what people sort of bet on, right? So I think really, It's the two things. It's the political expectations. I can see that. But it's also certainly the fact that this company invests into something that I think is increasingly valuable when it comes to defense. And that's basically a data-driven, AI-based intelligence, right?
In the last third of our podcast, I would like to speak about cooperation now. Can the U.S. and the various countries in Europe continue to work together? Can they continue to buy things together? In the past, we had these big joint projects like the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter, which was developed by a U.S. contractor, but made a point of working with contractors in all these different countries and all these different maintenance contracts. The idea was that everybody would buy some, everybody would contribute a share of the development, and then have jobs for their own industry as well as planes to fly around. Sharon, how did that work out?
So I said I'm not a good prognosticator, but I'm very decent, I think, at describing the present. I think the F-35 is the last of its kind. It's a dinosaur, not in the sense that some people say it's a dinosaur, but the F-35 grew out of an era. I mean, I'm old enough to remember back in 2000 when I first got into defense industrial base analysis, and people were talking, transatlantic defense cooperation was the sort of slogan. And people were talking about not just consolidation of defense industry, but a consolidation of the European and American primes. And there was support from that inside a lot of the Pentagon. That, the idea, okay, I don't know that there's going to be a Palantir. I don't even know who they would merge with. That's like, that's not in the works. So the F-35, it is still this important example of international defense cooperation. But if you take notice now, nobody's talking about an equivalent international program. And looking at the way politics is going, and with what we were talking about earlier, the concerns about being dependent on US software, I don't see another F-35 example in cooperation between Europe and the United States. You can talk about the Trump administration as an anomaly, but I think what we saw with the first Trump administration and then going into the Biden administration, there's a lot of continuity in the policies. So I even think whether it's, I mean, I personally don't think there's going to be a third Trump administration, but whether, let's say, it's a Vance or Rubio administration or it's some unknown Democratic administration, I think this break, I mean, I think you can have better relations, but I think some of the fundamental tensions in both the alliance and then in the underlying industrial cooperation, there's not going to be a huge turnaround in policy. And so that will be interesting for, you know, what that means in the future. The other thing with the F-35 is it is also now held up as an example, rightly or wrongly, I think a little bit of both, among the defense startups as precisely the type of procurement program that was a big mistake, you know, the $2 trillion program. So the idea that that will be a model for anything in the future, whether for procurement or international cooperation, seems highly unlikely.
Guntram, what do you think is the future?
My sense from looking at the type of warfare that I observe in Iran, that I observe in Ukraine, is that we will move away from very expensive platform-based, platform-centric military systems towards much smaller, more decentralized, more network-based, more data-driven-based weaponry. And in a sense, that's good news, in particular for the European continent, where it is more difficult to sort of really scale in a fragmented continent that is politically fragmented, because a lot of that stuff can be produced at much lower sort of fixed costs, much lower development costs, with much faster development cycles. So the key to unlocking that kind of potential is, to my mind, the changes in the way we procure, the decentralization and the agility with which procurement agencies can actually procure. And I think Ukraine leads the way there, and I think we will need to move all in that direction. I mean, just to give you this one number, in Ukraine, 80%, 90% of the successful hits by the Ukrainian armed forces are done with drones, right? I mean, so yes, NATO, yes, our countries would fight differently from Ukraine. But yes, there is a big lesson to be drawn here, and this has not yet really been fully drawn across European militaries.
How important is it in Europe for the EU to work with Norway, with the UK, with the region versus only within an EU context? Or is the EU itself the wrong unit since there isn't unanimity among the 27 members?
I mean, I don't think we need necessarily the EU as a whole. I think we will have variable geometry. We are seeing at the level of the militaries, for example, the Joint Expeditionary Forces, which is a grouping around the UK and the Nordic countries of Europe, including the Netherlands also. They do joint maneuvers. They do some joint procurement. They cooperate very closely together. We see other initiatives, a German-Dutch cooperation. We see significant cooperation with the Ukrainians. So I do think there will be some variable geometry. I think it's going to be mostly concentrated in the countries north and east of, I would say, Brussels, and not south and west of Brussels.
Sharon, you spent some time in Poland, which is right on the frontier. What was your sense?
Of where they're going?
Well, I'm thinking more of these relationships between and among European countries with different attitudes towards defense and military spending. Poland, of course, is on the frontier with Ukraine, and so there's a lot of question about how aid moves in and what comes back, people moving back and forth. I mean, there's just so much. It's such a nexus for the EU-Ukrainian relationship, and in the context we've been talking about procurement, about cooperation, about attitudes, I'm wondering what you saw on the ground and how that fits in.
You know, every country in the European Union is going to be a little bit unique depending on their circumstances. I do think Poland is in a particularly unique situation. How well they're navigating it, hard to say, because, you know, you have the strained, you know, US within the NATO alliance, that relationship. But Poland has always felt like that they're the guarantor of security is not NATO per se, but the United States. So I think more than other countries, They have really pivoted their defense procurement to build up those relationships with the United States. I mean, there have been some issues where they have bought from South Korea as well, because everybody is facing that we talked about very early on this program, this backlog, this incredible backlog for basic defense equipment. So it's not that they're just buying from the US, but they very much see buying US equipment, just as they saw having US troops on the ground, as part of the guarantee of their, of their security position. So again, yes, it's NATO, but they really want that partnership with the US. So on the flip side of that is they are also trying to adapt based on what they see in the war in Ukraine in terms of drones. I haven't looked at what they're doing. These things do change very quickly, and it's been about a year, maybe 18 months since I've looked closely. I don't get the sense that they're moving as fast as the Baltic states are, Estonia. I mean, a lot of these countries are getting all in on drone production and drone sensors. My general impression, and I could be wrong, is that Poland hasn't moved as fast into that with domestic production, where it's really been impressive what the Baltic states, particularly Estonia, have and are doing. And I think it's getting to the point, and you're seeing this now in Iran operations, where the US is having to draw on Ukraine expertise, Ukraine's experience, and much more on like how do we defend against drone attacks. So I think there will be a point, especially with the Baltic states, where in some areas they're going to be further ahead of us. Now, does that make them secure and all that? No, they still need the NATO alliance, but it's interesting to see like who's moving faster in the direction. What is it? The phrase, necessity is the mother of invention, but nothing produces necessity like wars.
I could ask you guys questions all day, but we are coming to the end of our time. What should I have asked that I haven't asked yet? Or what piece do you think listeners need to make sense of all this? Is there a thing that you want to add that might help some of this come together?
I guess one point that is useful to add is that, I mean, in a sense, all what we are discussing here is actually very sad stuff, right? And I think for listeners and many young listeners, I really sort of feel sorry sometimes for them that, we are having to discuss these kind of things. Because honestly, this relation with Russia is really in a very bad state. And the Russian president has become more and more entrenched in his attitudes, negative attitudes of trying to win this, trying to sort of overcome NATO, overcome and this adversary relation, right? And it's only getting worse also in the wider context. So in that sense, I feel quite sad about where we are at the moment. And really would have hoped that this wouldn't have been the topics we have to discuss. But given where we are, and given what kind of sort of threats there are, literal threats on our citizens, on our people. Every day we see hybrid attacks across the continent from Russia, from other players. I do think we all have to think about and address these issues. And so, yes, it's in a sad state of mind, but I think it's better to do that than to sort of just ignore the topic and then face later on much graver consequences because you fail to deter the adversary.
I have to admit, I think one of, I mean, this maybe goes beyond the scope of our conversation, but since a lot of what we talked about is a result in not everything. I think the defense industrial base issues face every administration, conservative or liberal, in the United States. But a lot of what we're talking about in terms of the tensions of NATO, the attitude towards Russia is rooted in part in the current political administration in the United States, which has, as part of its sort of strategy, talked about, has addressed the political situation in Europe, which is so unusual, talking about, free, what this administration considers freedom and free speech. What would happen the if you have in power sort of the more, right, far right political powers that you have in the United States? Because certainly the Trump administration and Vice President Vance have sort of talked about this. They feel this sort of, community of the right. I don't know what to call it. Maybe someone has a better term. But would they, in terms of national security and international relations, would they still have the same interests with right or far right governments that they seem to support in Europe? I suspect not. I suspect that's a fantasy. Now, this may never come to fruition. We've seen with the changes in Hungary, but that's the interesting question. So if you had the rise of, the right, far right, whatever you want to call them, in a number of countries in Europe, what would then be the relations with the United States? I don't know that it would be this happy coalition that shows up at CPAC in the United States. I think it would be a very, very different transatlantic relationship, even more than we have now.
I mean, just one word on that. I mean, it goes beyond what we can discuss here. But basically, the far right parties in Europe have come to realize that it's actually a liability for them to get associated with Trump. So I think they're really begging off and really trying to say, okay, we also want to do nationalism, but by the way, our nationalism is different to the one of the US president, and we don't submit ourselves to the rule of the White House.
Yeah, there's no, I don't think there's an international brotherhood of nationalism, or at
No,
least not yet.
not really.
That's the whole thing about defense economics, is it? Is impossible to discuss without getting into these questions of strategy, priorities, values. It's such a big topic. We've touched on it a little here. I'm incredibly grateful to Sharon Weinberger to joining us from Washington, Guntram Wolf here in Brussels with me, Rebecca Christie. We will link to Sharon's books and Guntram's articles and other neat things in the show notes. You've been listening to The Sound of Economics from Bruegel. Thanks and have a good day.